Hey, it's Marco Werman.
And Carolyn Buehler.
You know the show and count on this podcast for global news with a special twist. But this podcast exists thanks to public radio stations.
If you don't already listen to your local public radio station, think about giving it a try. It's a great way to keep up with what's going on in your own community and discover more great shows.
And if you're so inclined, with your public radio station holding their spring pledge drive right now, help them expand their reach and service by giving whatever amount works for you.
And thanks.
Haiti and the Dominican Republic are neighbors on the same island, and the DR is not immune to the violence and chaos in Haiti.
The feeling in the Dominican population is that we've been left alone to handle the Haitian crisis.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Also today, the two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians. It's been seen as impossible at many points over the years, but not by everyone in the region.
Those who say the conflict is insoluble are those who don't want to solve it.
And Koreans love their baseball. Today, Seoul hosted MLB season opener, where a Japanese player is much loved by fans in Korea.
Koreans would say he has a soft face.
That is a compliment for superstar Shohei Ohtani. All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. Haiti is scrambling to find new leadership. Its prime minister resigned last month. Heavily armed gangs now control the country's main airport and seaport. And this week, those gangs launched attacks in some of the capital's wealthiest neighborhoods and targeted Haiti's central bank headquarters.
Last week, U.S. and Caribbean officials gave Haitian leaders 24 hours to name a transitional council for appointing a new prime minister. That still hasn't happened. Haiti shares the island of Hispaniola with its neighbor to the east, the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Foreign Minister, Roberto Alvarez, told me earlier today that it is not his country's job to restore order inside Haiti.
That is not our role. It cannot be our role for several reasons. We've had over our independence years since 1844, a troubled history with Haiti. As a matter of fact, our independence in 1844 is from Haiti. We were occupied for 22 years by Haiti. So we must maintain a certain distance from the transition. We will support and we will collaborate in every way possible, as we do now, but we cannot actually intervene in any way directly.
You mentioned maintain distance from Haiti. Right now, you are restricting border crossings. You've put 10,000 soldiers on the border. A Jesuit priest that we spoke to yesterday in a Dominican border town told us that Haitians are sleeping in the forests there because they fear midnight deportations. Is that a humane policy?
There is no Haitian army. So the entire border has to be protected exclusively by Dominican armed forces, number one. Number two, we have collaborated with Haitians themselves. We've had up to 15,000 Haitian students in the Dominican Republic. As a matter of fact, in 2023, 16% of our health budget was used by Haitians. 37% of our maternity wards in our public hospitals were used by Haitian women for free. So we are doing more than enough. The feeling in the Dominican population is that we've been left alone to handle the Haitian crisis. So it is not up to us to solve the Haitian situation at the moment. It's up to the Haitians, and what they need is assistance at multilateral force, which has been approved by the Security Council of the United Nations, to get there as soon as possible so some type of semblance of law and order can be established.
However, these deportations are still happening. Is deporting Haitians from the Dominican Republic right now inhumane, given the violence that people are returning to?
Well, we comply with international norms. We do it following due process, and we have to comply with our laws. That's what our laws state, and we cannot allow our country to be overrun or to be used as a solution to the Haitian crisis. We will never allow the Dominican Republic to be the scapegoat.
Some are calling on the Dominican Republic to create a humanitarian corridor that would help get aid into Haiti and get some of the injured folks in Haiti and others out. Would you support this idea?
About a month ago, maybe less, the main prison in Haiti was freed by the gangs, and there are about 5,000 criminals set loose. To us, the situation in Haiti is a question of national security. We have to look out for our security first and foremost.
So is that a no?
Under the current circumstances, we cannot go into the next step, which we have done in the past. The Dominican Republic has provided humanitarian assistance numerous times. Once certain law and order basic is established, we will definitely be there.
So until the security situation is improved in Haiti, you're saying no humanitarian corridor into the Dominican Republic?
We have to protect our national security comes first.
I understand that the Dominican Republic is reportedly a transit point for weapons and that Dominican banks are used by gang leaders. What can be done about that?
Actually, the United States is the one that has been sending, as far as I know, I have not seen any evidence whatsoever. The only report that I've seen in the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, reported in March of last year, had indications that maybe there was a transit, the Dominican Republic was transit. The reason being that a lot of the containers going into Haiti because of the violent situation in Haiti have to come through the Dominican Republic. So the burden, again, is on us. We produce no weapons, none whatsoever. We have no weapons factories or ammunition factories in the Dominican Republic. So they come from abroad. And we're trying our level best to stop any trafficking in arms or whatever. We do our very best. We collaborate, but there is no interlocutor on the other side. Basically, the police, the Haitian police, has broken down. Who are we going to speak to on the other side in order to be able to establish some type of normal processes for anything that happens?
I understand. You know, in your answers, you've been saying there needs to be a distance between the Dominican Republic and Haiti at this moment. But I'm wondering if there is anything else that officials in your country can do to help authorities in Haiti stand up to these gangs.
We have numerous binational markets along our 391-kilometer border. They are open. Were it not for that, I think that the sort of terrible malnutrition in the Haitian population would be greater. But given the situation, the control that the gangs have of the roads that exit Haiti, we cannot afford. We've had many of our nationals kidnapped by the gangs. So we can't expose ourselves beyond what we are doing at the moment.
Finally, what security concerns are raised for the Dominican Republic due to the spiraling crisis in Haiti?
Well, let me give you one and only one at this moment, because I really don't want to get into that hypothetical. We depend on tourism. It is our first income, source of income. Right now, there are countries already canceling reservations to the Dominican Republic. Just the fact that we are neighbors of Haiti.
So this is a potential blow to the economy.
National security depends on it. The economy is only one. I don't even want to go into other aspects that are sort of at work here as well. If you had gang members coming into Dominican territory, just one person can wreak havoc. We cannot allow that, anything like that to happen. And we will not.
Roberto Alvarez is the foreign minister of the Dominican Republic. He joined us from the capital, Santo Domingo.
Opening day is next week, and ballparks across North America are gearing up. But the first pitch of the 2024 Major League Baseball season was actually thrown today in Seoul, South Korea.
Off the end of the bat, into left center field. That gets the job done.
The LA Dodgers came away with a 5-2 win over the San Diego Padres. They play again tomorrow at, 6 a.m. Eastern Time, if you're a fan. The Seoul Series is the first time MLB regular season games have been played in South Korea. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on how fans there are welcoming some of the game's biggest stars.
Ha Sung Kim has been the face of the Seoul Series ever since it was announced last year.
San Diego 유니폼을 입고 한국에서 뛸 수 있다는 것이 얼마나 기쁘고 행복한지 말로 표현할 수 없습니다.
In a promo video, Kim said, "I can't express how happy I am to be able to play in my home country of Korea in a San Diego uniform." The shortstop started his professional career in Korea before joining the Padres in late 2020 when he landed a $28 million contract. And Southern California has been good to him.
Kim to left. Back goes Carroll. That's the ballgame. Ha-Sung Kim walks it off.
Last year, Kim became the first Korean-born player to win the MLB's coveted Gold Glove Award. Korean fans have followed him closely, and so far, Kim has given them exactly what they want.
1-2 pitch is driven in the air to deep left field. Back goes Moon at the wall. It is gone.
At the very stadium where he used to play in the Korean League, Kim hit a home run earlier this week during an exhibition game. The crowd, as you can imagine, was on their feet. Then he did it again.
Ha-Sung Kim returns to Korea, hits his second home run of this exhibition game.
어디서 치든 홈런은 좋은 것 같고, 네, 뭐 운이 좋았던 것 같습니다.
At a press conference after the game, Kim said hitting a home run in any ballpark feels good, and he thinks it was luck that brought him two in a row.
그리고 뭐 저 같은 경우는 한국에서 뛰었을 때 좀 상대를 했던 투수들이기 때문에.
Kim added that he's played with many of the Korean pitchers before, so he knows what they throw and has a bit of an advantage. Baseball fans aren't the only ones taking notice that Kim's in town. Even Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol showed up to the ball field to meet the 28-year-old. Other players are getting major attention this week, too. Dodgers designated hitter Shohei Ohtani got a very warm welcome when he landed in South Korea.
A lot of these crowds that show up to the airport are organized online by fan clubs.
Rachel Ju is a professor at Middlebury College in Vermont and has written extensively about sports and Korea. She says the fan club for Shohei Ohtani is called Showtime.
For those fans, he really transcends national differences.
Ohtani is from Japan, which colonized Korea from 1910 to 1945. That history has led to tension in sports. In 2006, Japanese baseball legend Ichiro expressed what many believe to be anti-Korean sentiments, vaguely disguised as competitive banter. Ohtani, Ju says, is really different.
His entire approach to Korea has been one of friendship, and Koreans would say he has a soft face. It's not soft as in, you know, doughy, but he has a kind face. And he has a face that feels approachable, and he's not a braggart.
The 29-year-old is also great at what he does, which makes him easy to cheer for. And his new team, the Dodgers, gives him even more brownie points in Korea.
Dodgers was the first team to recruit the first Korean major leaguer.
Nari Shin is an assistant professor of sport management at the University of Michigan. She says the Dodgers were key in Koreans joining the MLB when they welcomed Chan-ho Park in 1994. That reception still means a lot to people in Korea, Shin says, where baseball is one of the most popular professional sports.
So Dodgers has some special space in Korean people's mind.
Korea is just the first international stop for the MLB this season. The Houston Astros will play the Colorado Rockies in Mexico City next month, and the New York Mets will take on the Phillies in London in June. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The Prime Minister of Ireland delivered a surprise announcement today. He's quitting. 45-year-old Leo Varadkar made history in Ireland as the country's first openly gay and first biracial prime minister. He was also the youngest ever. Today he told the country his reasons for stepping down are both personal and political, but he didn't give any more details.
Politicians are human beings and we have our limitations. We give it everything until we can't anymore, and then we have to move on.
Even veteran political observers did not see this coming, though Varadkar had expressed frustration at how polarized politics have become in Ireland as in other countries. Earlier this month, Irish voters rejected a referendum that he supported. It would have broadened the definition of family in Ireland's constitution. Previously, Leo Varadkar played a leading role in helping to get same-sex marriage legalized in Ireland and repealing a nationwide ban on abortion.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Drivers in Cambodia can get pretty creative. Truck horns like this one can actually get young people dancing on the roadside. It can be good fun, but what caught the attention of Cambodia's prime minister is this. Hun Manet was apparently alarmed by social media videos that show kids dancing in the street as trucks barrel towards them, and he's now imposed a ban on these creative truck horns. Soon Norin is a journalist in Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh. Norin, why were truck horns made musical in the first place?
In this country, mostly the truck drivers, they don't really respect the law. By law, they should have the standard horns, but they make the musical one because they think it's more funny, it can draw attention. So that's why they make the musical horns. And we see this only mainly in the remote countryside, the remote roads where police not positioned, not in the capital, but because of the children and youth go dancing, that's why it draw a lot of attention.
So truck drivers know that they're not actually supposed to use these musical horns, but when they're out of sight of authorities in the countryside, they do.
They do as they know that it just make fun and jokes, so it's not draw attention from police, and police do not take action against that. But because the prime minister now say something, that's why police now take action. And we see a lot of reports via news that police did take action against the truck drivers who use musical horns.
So musical horns out, but standard horns with one tone are okay. Is the viral meme a situation where kids are daring each other to dance in front of the trucks?
It's provoked a lot of discussion because the traffic accident in this country is high. At least we can say on average per day, 5 people die on the road accident. So it draws a lot of attention, but it's also weird why this time the kids and youth, they start dancing on the street, and the government official feel is encourage other kids and youth. So that's why they put the ban on.
It does sound like the government is concerned about the competition between kids and getting likes and shares on social media and this whole trend getting out of control.
Correct, yeah, because it got a lot of attention, and it's also illegal that the truck drivers, they also use musical horns.
Norin, the videos that I've seen, though, they show young people dancing on the side of the road, and it looks pretty fun. Have any of the people who are dancing to these musical truck horns, have they been injured or hit by the trucks?
So far, there is no report about that, because when the trucks come, they drive very slow, but this draw a lot of attention from the official because they think it's unwise to do such things. And traffic accident is top one in this country.
Yeah, leading cause of death, traffic accidents in Cambodia, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
I mean, the musical horns, as we heard, they're fun. Are some people outside of the government sad to see them go?
No, because a lot of reaction from the social media user thinks it's unwise to do that. That's why the government need to take actions.
So not only is social media being used by kids to show their dance moves with these musical truck horns, but social media is also being used by other Cambodians who are concerned about what this could all lead to. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, they share those videos and they say it's not really appropriate to do such kind of stuff. And they call on government to take any actions. And what government can do is to put bans on any musical horns.
Soon Norin is a journalist in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
In the 2 years since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, countless Ukrainian families have been severely impacted. Many decided to leave the country. Thousands settled here in the U.S. Lindsay Sievert, reporting for Minnesota Public Radio News, spent some time with two Ukrainian students who now live outside of Minneapolis.
Good morning, Athena.
Good morning, Luke.
Good morning.
This fourth grade class at Rice Lake Elementary in Maple Grove starts with fist bumps.
Good morning, Melody.
Friend to friend until it's Artem Fedorenko's turn.
Good morning. Good morning, Artem.
Good morning, Melody. Good morning, Bo.
Good morning, Artem.
Good morning,
Soshi. Artem left Ukraine 2 years ago. He's not alone. A world map in the English learner room shows a cluster of arrows over Ukraine.
Everything, this little end of the arrow, it's all pointing into the Ukraine.
It's the biggest concentration on your map.
It is.
The school now has more than 24 Ukrainian students, including Artem's best friend at school and at home, Nika Kravchenko.
It's my friend from Ukraine.
Here he comes.
Вообще нормально.
He likes his class, teachers, food.
We first met up with them last summer at their new home in Maple Grove, where Artem opened a drawer to reveal the reason he came to Minnesota. He proudly waves his prosthetic arm, holds it up, right where his left arm is missing.
He can do everything he wants. He's a good example for all of us.
That's Ina Karpenko, Nika's mom. She's a former English teacher interpreting for Oksana Shpachkovich, Artem's mom.
It's a big chance for us to begin a new life from the new page.
2 years ago, Artem visited his dad at a cabin outside Kyiv. The Russians invaded. And Artem's dad died, shielding him from a bomb.
And why it had happened to my son, I will always feel this pain for him, because it's better that happened to me. Now he has, like, different life.
He is quite a character.
Yakov Grodinar founded the Protez Foundation in Oakdale. He holds a blowtorch, molding a prosthetic. A Ukrainian living in Minnesota, Grodinar made Artem's prosthetic arm, the first child he treated. More than 15 new amputees just arrived from Ukraine. During physical therapy, they all move in rhythm. One man is missing both legs. Another, both arms.
Why kids has to suffer and lose their limbs? It's like, why?
Back at school, a classmate grabs Artem's coat, helps him put his arm through the sleeve, then zips it up.
Okay, fair.
It's recess. Artem dominates the soccer field, scoring goals, picking up the ball with one arm for a penalty kick.
It's a goal!
He appoints himself team captain. His teacher, Jennifer Ottinger, notices how students respond to Artem's spirit.
Artem is amazing. There will be some times when he's sharing and he might just go into the whole thing about how I miss my dad, but if it weren't for him, I wouldn't be here right now.
Artem's friend Nika is on to another art project.
We're going to cut it into four pieces.
I have really good friends here and everybody is so nice and calm.
Her dad is still in Ukraine, fighting in the war.
Artem and Athena.
And Artem? He's not focused on what is lost. His prosthetic arm is shoved under his desk, resting at his feet.
1:15, 2:25.
Artem is learning to tell time.
2 hours and 25 minutes.
About the way it moves forward.
3:30.
And doesn't turn back.
Excellent. Good. Senya, how do you
For the world, this? I'm Lindsay Sievert, Maple Grove, Minnesota.
1:50. You're listening to The World. One of the hottest dishes in Portugal is a traditional stew from Cape Verde.
It's definitely a topic of conversation among people who are sort of fanatical about food in Lisbon. It's like, where's your favorite cachupa? That's something that everyone is going to have an opinion on.
Ahead, we'll meet Portugal's self-proclaimed king of this stew. All coming up on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today repeated that Israel will move forward with a ground offensive into Rafah. That's the southern city in the Gaza Strip, now crowded with about 1.5 million Palestinian civilians. The Biden administration, among others, has been warning the Israelis against sending the military into Rafah without a plan to protect civilians.
Palestinians mourned and prayed this morning outside of a hospital in central Gaza. 28 people were killed in 3 separate Israeli airstrikes last night, according to the Associated Press. Bodies were wrapped in funeral shrouds and taken away on donkey carts for burial. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced that he will return to Israel this week for his 6th mission to the Middle East since the war between Israel and Hamas began. During a visit to the Philippines, Blinken spoke about the need for humanitarian assistance in Gaza.
If you look at some of the assessments that we're seeing now, 100% of the population in Gaza is at severe levels of acute food insecurity. That's the first time an entire population has been so classified.
Beyond the immediate crisis, there's the long-term challenge of finding a way toward lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians, which is where we turn our attention now. The stated goal of U.S. presidents going back decades has been to form a two-state solution, an independent Palestinian state alongside the State of Israel. Many say that if the door was not already closed on that possibility long ago, it surely has shut since October 7th. Reporter Rebecca Rossman recently met with two men who know each other well and have been working most of their lives to achieve peace.
Yossi Beilin is a familiar and often comforting face on the Israeli political left. Maybe that's because of his optimism.
I've believed all my life that there is no reason why we will not have peace in the Middle East.
That may sound like a tall, if not naive, order these days. But Beilin knows what he's talking about. The 75-year-old was one of the key negotiators of the 1993 Oslo Accords, which laid the groundwork for a two-state solution. When we meet in his humble apartment in North Tel Aviv, he confidently tells me it's something he still believes in.
Those who say that conflict is insoluble are those who don't want to solve it, mainly because they believe that the land is sacred and it is God-given to them, on the Palestinian side or on the Israeli side.
In other words, Beilin blamed the extremes of both sides for stalling efforts towards peace. And while right now the discussions about a two-state solution are at best on hold, Beilin tells me he actually sees the current conflict between Israel and Hamas as an opportunity.
You talk to people in Tel Aviv, the most moderate city in Israel, and you see people are saying, no, we cannot make peace with the Palestinians and whatever. But on the other hand, almost all the peace treaties were signed after war.
He references World War II, which led to the establishment of the European Union.
The bottom line is that the need for peace is much bigger after war than without war.
But when I head to East Jerusalem to meet with Sari Nusseibeh, a prominent Palestinian philosopher and writer, I'm given a slightly less hopeful sense. In the 1990s, Nusseibeh says he was also a big proponent of the two-state solution. But it's not something he thinks could happen now.
People are not ready or ripe for it. Look, on the Israeli side, there's total mistrust of the Palestinians as a whole, for good reason. On the Palestinian side, there's total disbelief in Israel's willingness in a solution that will be seen by them, by the Palestinians, as a part of a fair deal.
Nusseibeh tells me for years the idea of two states for two peoples was an idea that stirred his imagination. It gave him hope. But a number of things starting in the early 2000s unraveled that hope. On the Palestinian side, it was the rising popularity of extremist groups like Hamas, which has always advocated for the destruction of Israel. On the Israeli side, it was things like the increase of Jewish settlements in the West Bank and dealing with a leader like the current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, someone he says only wants peace with Palestinians in a way he sees fit.
Which is to sort of submit them into some kind of state of, I don't want to call it slavery, but some kind of state of docile sheep.
On that point, Yossi Beilin tells me he doesn't disagree. In fact, when he reflects on what ultimately killed the Oslo Accords, he points many fingers at Netanyahu.
It is Netanyahu who never wanted a permanent agreement because he knew what it meant. And it meant a partition of the land.
In other words, an end to many Israeli settlements. Beilin and Nusseibeh tell me they agree on the point that the biggest obstacle to achieving peace today is finding two leaders from both sides who really want it and establishing trust, something Nusseibeh says can only be achieved through keeping ties, especially in times like this.
You know, we each of us see the other as evil. I think it's up to us, and it is possible for each of us to work on actually getting each of us better. And by making the other better, life becomes better for yourself. This is a very important secret.
That's when Nusseibeh confides with me that despite feeling pessimistic about a two-state solution, he's actually by nature an optimist. He quotes a line from Shakespeare's Henry V, "There's some soul of goodness in things evil. Would men observingly distill it out?"
You think people are evil. Even the most evil, you can go in and see the good in them and bring it out.
And that's what Nusseibeh and Beilin say this all really comes down to. Two opposing sides figuring out how to find the good in the other. It's something they've both dedicated their lives to. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Jerusalem.
Our next conversation may not be suitable for all listeners. Since 2015, there's been a ban in the West African country of the Gambia on the controversial practice of cutting young girls, female genital mutilation, or FGM. It has no medical benefits. It's painful and can cause serious scarring, infertility, even death. Right now, though, Gambian lawmakers are debating whether to end the ban on FGM. Fatou Balde is an activist who wants to make sure the practice remains outlawed in the Gambia. She spoke with us from the capital, Banjul.
Female genital mutilation is a practice that has already affected over 75% of women and girls between the age of 15 to 49 in the Gambia. And for many, many years, for over the last three decades, we've been fighting to have a ban on FGM. So that is why it is really sad and painful that in 2024, our parliamentarians are taking a step towards repealing that 2015 law.
Yeah, before we go on, 75% of women and girls in the Gambia have undergone this procedure. Has that number decreased at all since 2015, since the ban was in place?
There hasn't been any studies like that has gone in depth to look into that. But one thing I can assure you is that due to the advocacy and having the law in place, organizations like ours have been able to go at the grassroots to educate people, to also break that culture of silence around female genital mutilation in general, because there used to be a big culture of silence where survivors were told not to talk about what happened to them. But we broke that culture of silence, and people are openly speaking up about their experiences and how FGM has affected them. So a lot of progress has been achieved.
Yes. So, Fatou, help us understand that after being outlawed, why is FGM back on the agenda in the Gambia's National Assembly? How did that happen?
We had a successful conviction in last August where three women were convicted of cutting a group of girls. And that resulted in some religious leaders coming forward. And in fact, one of the leading religious leaders in the country paid a fine and since then waged a complete war against women's rights and FGM advocates against FGM and said that the law has to be repealed. He has received a lot of support. For centuries, communities have been practicing it. And there is a misconception that FGM is a religious obligation, especially associated with Islam.
I saw the other day that there were demonstrations in front of Parliament in Banjul in favor of repealing the ban. Who else has joined this movement to end the ban on FGM? And why do they say this needs to happen?
Since this whole debate started, our government have been completely silenced. They have not spoken to us. They have not come out and issued statement to say that the importance of maintaining that law. So that also emboldened these religious leaders who think that they can push for the ban to be lifted. But we stayed defiant. And I say to people that this is the first time Gambian women came out, survivors came out. I myself, I am a survivor of female genital mutilation. I was mutilated when I was 8 years old. And there were a lot of survivors like myself there who insisted that we must go in. We must also show that we do not want that legislation to be repealed and we want protection for our girls in this country.
Fatou, you may have seen this. Some in the Gambia have talked about the ban on the practice of FGM as something that's been influenced by the West. How do you respond to that?
So Gambia is not an island. We are part of the international and the global community, and we have a responsibility. It is okay for us. We are used to being told that we are influenced. Likewise, we are also saying that these people are extremists because what they are preaching and what they are doing, that's not Islam. I am a Muslim, and I know that it's not Islam. The hate that they are speaking of, that's not Islam. Islam preaches peace and respect for women. This is extremism. This is beyond FGM. I believe they are using FGM because they know that communities are still in support of it. They are using it as an entry point to embolden themselves, to give themselves powers for more and more agendas. And that is why these people are dangerous.
So there is a 3-month period where the debate will be investigated. I mean, it is so clear for those who oppose the ban and for people like you who support it, want to keep it in place. What is your hope of what these 3 months are going to reveal?
Well, I hope the different committees that are going to handle these really do their investigations with open minds. They consult the relevant people. You speak to a lot of the MPs, they will tell you that if I do not vote for the repeal, my people will not re-elect me. And that is the same reason our government is silent, because if they speak, people will say they've taken a side. And because of that, they are being mute, because they are also thinking about elections coming up. So as I keep saying, they are using the bodies of women as a political tool.
Fatou, thank you very much for your time and candor.
Thank you very much.
Fatou Baldé is the founder and CEO of the Gambian nonprofit Women in Liberation and Leadership.
On the islands of Cape Verde, a stew made of beans, hominy, and smoked sausage is a longtime favorite. It's called cachupa, and it appears on kitchen tables as well as fancy restaurant menus. The dish is also attracting a devoted following in the country that once colonized the islands, Portugal. In the capital of Lisbon, the world's Duri Buscarin takes us into the kitchen of Cape Verde's growing diaspora.
Okay, you see the process?
Tony Fox calls himself the king of cachupa. But that title might be too humble, he explains, as he fries some onions for a garnish.
But my son think I'm doing too much cachupa, my son think I'm too small to be king. I want to be importer de cachupa. I think it's much better.
Once you step inside his restaurant, you understand why he thinks the title Emperor of Cachupa might fit. The stewed meat, tender hominy, and spices blend perfectly into a bowl on a chilly day, topped with a generous dash of homemade hot sauce. It's like coming home to a hug. Fox makes cachupa with fish, cachupa refried with an egg on top. His signature cachupa is lovingly wrapped in a bright green cabbage leaf. Fox says it all started as a bet with a friend.
Yeah, the guy said to me like that, Fox, you don't want to do cachupa? I said, no, I don't like cachupa, I don't make to do cachupa.
Fox was already a chef. While his parents are from Cape Verde, he was born in Lisbon. He had learned how to make Portuguese food for Portuguese diners. But Fox called his dad, got some advice, called his aunties, catered some events, and people loved it.
This business coming for joking to my friends. Now, everybody know about cachupa.
In the dining room, a group of co-workers share pots of cachupa with a couple carafes of red wine. Elder Cruz was born in Lisbon, but like Tony Fox, his parents are from Cape Verde. He organizes the office cachupa trip every other week.
We always come here, always. Because it's good.
For Clara Rodrigues, it was her first time trying cachupa. She says she really liked it too, because it reminded her of a chickpea stew from Alentejo, the region of southern Portugal where her parents are from. There's a reason the flavors are familiar to Lisbonites, says Celia Pedroso, a Portuguese food writer. Portugal colonized Cape Verde in 1462. And used it as a stopping point on transatlantic shipping routes.
They were bringing and trading all kinds of food items, plants, and spices.
And human beings. This bloody history created a link between places as far away as Macau, the Indian island of Goa, and Brazil. And the culinary traditions of these places began to evolve together.
In Brazil, they found amazing ingredients they had never seen. And so the corn would become a staple ingredient in Africa and in Cape Verdean food.
Cape Verde won its independence after the fall of Portugal's dictatorship in 1974, and many families moved to Portugal. Pedroso remembers going to Cape Verdean restaurants as early as the 1980s, but only recently, she says, have Portuguese diners really begun to appreciate Cape Verdean food. Her colleague, Ansel Mullins, agrees.
It's definitely a topic of conversation among people who are sort of fanatical about food in Lisbon. It's like, where's your favorite cachupa? That's something that everyone is going to have an opinion on.
Mullins is the founder of Culinary Backstreets, which gives food tours in several cities across the world, including Lisbon. He and Pedroso developed their own food tour in Lisbon to highlight the cuisines of former Portuguese colonies. Shrimp samosas from Goa, cheese puffs from Brazil, popsicles made out of baobab tree nuts from Guinea-Bissau, and of course, cachupa.
It's such an interesting way to understand Portuguese history, and not only that, but Portuguese society.
The strands of this history can also be tasted in a bar called Liquid Love, a bar that started as a love story.
We met at a bar, working in the same bar.
Sheila Tavares' parents are from Cape Verde and Angola. Her partner, Sami Mazouhi, is Tunisian and Italian. They met in London.
And there as well was super multicultural, so we learned how to work with some of the ingredients that are things that we love.
Together, they make cocktails inspired by both their heritage and their travels. For instance, Tavares takes grog, a type of sugarcane rum made by a Cape Verdean company in Lisbon, and combines it with West African and Mediterranean flavors, like coconut, banana, and fig leaf.
It has these notes of the sugarcane, a little bit grassy as well, and sometimes it has these notes of olive brine, too.
She named the drink Morabeza, the Cape Verdean word for hospitality. Tavares grew up in Lisbon. She says she remembers kids at school, judging the lunches her mother packed for her. But now, she says, Portuguese diners are seeking out Cape Verdean food, too.
And now it's being talked about it, and it's being appreciated, and it's being, you know, admired by other people. So it's amazing to see. It's definitely a movement.
For the World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Lisbon, Portugal.
You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A Texas law that would allow the state to deport unauthorized migrants is on hold. It was briefly instated yesterday, but a court blocked it just hours later. The Mexican government says it would not accept deportations made by Texas under any circumstances. We wanted to hear more from the Mexican perspective. Rafael Fernandez de Castro Medina directs the Center for U.S.-Mexican Studies at UC San Diego.
Texas has been very mean with the immigrants, and they're doing all sorts of actions against immigrants. So we want to tell Texas, you shouldn't do this, but we have to receive Mexicans. There's no way that we cannot accept Mexicans. What you have to understand, Carolina, and this is very important, is that we're also in political times. There's elections in Mexico this year. So the response to Texas is very nationalistic, but it's coming out of a Mexico that is mean and fed up with Texas because the governor of Texas has been very harsh to immigrants.
The situation at the border is constantly in flux. There are frequent policy changes, and that's related to the political and legal battles going on here in the U.S. But I'm curious, how do those constantly changing policies impact things on the Mexican side of the border? What does that look like?
I'll tell you something, Carl. I believe the U.S. government has many different models, separating the children under Trump, Title 42, stay in Mexico. And what we have to understand is that the U.S.-Mexico border is connected with the well-being of the world. If there's problems in Ukraine, we're going to feel that in Mexico. When Russia invaded Ukraine in March 2022, we started to have, Caroline, between 1,000 and 1,200 Ukrainians coming to Tijuana every single day, flying into Tijuana. So nowadays that Europe has become harsher with immigrants, there's people from all over the place coming into the U.S.-Mexico border. So again, our border is connected to the well-being of the world, but particularly to the well-being of the Western Hemisphere.
The makeup of people crossing through Mexico to get to the United States has changed over the years. It's no longer mostly Mexicans. It's people from all over the world, especially Central America. So what a power does Mexico have in this situation when people are deported back to Mexico?
Well, Mexico has a deal with the U.S., and Biden got this deal, that we accept foreign nationals from Central America, from Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Haiti, and Cubans, okay? But this is a special agreement. The ones that we really need to accept are the Mexicans. And see this, Caroline. This is not new. In 2010, Arizona had a law similar to the one that Texas has nowadays. Basically, since 2004, when George W. Bush was campaigning for re-election, he said the U.S. migration system is broken, we need immigration reform, and in the last 20 years, there hasn't been immigration reform. So that's why the states like Arizona, like Texas, in the past, also Colorado and Utah, they've been trying to do things because they're very tired of this gridlock in Congress about immigration reform. And let's face it, the U.S. immigration system doesn't work. And that makes things very difficult for Mexico, for the U.S., and especially for the border.
In the long history of migration across the southern border, have you seen this degree of uncertainty and disagreement before?
No, you're absolutely right. This is the time for Mexico and the U.S. and Canada and Central America and Colombia. This is a hemispheric issue. We really should try to cooperate on this and try to have orderly and legal migration flows, because let's face it, there's too many people coming in, and we must do better because the crisis is there. And again, our border is connected to the well-being of the entire world.
Rafael Fernandez de Castro Medina directs the Center for U.S.-Mexican Studies at UC San Diego.
I am surrounded by the Amazon rainforest, the sounds of it anyway. I'm looking at a video installation in the University Art Gallery on the campus at San Diego State University. Artist Melanie Smith's close-ups of frogs and other small jungle wildlife. One work on display in an exhibit titled Imaginary Amazon. There are visual pieces that remind you that this massive area, roughly the size of the U.S. lower 48, has an equally large hold over many people's imaginations.
All different kinds of groups of people have different images of what the Amazon means. There might be stereotypes about the tropics and this beautiful place of beautiful flowers and tropical landscapes.
Curator Jillian Sneed explained to me that Imaginary Amazon is intended to be a counterweight to some of the unflattering perspectives trafficked for centuries by the global north.
There are other kinds of imaginaries, the imaginaries of the indigenous people who live there, their cosmologies of how they see the world, or their ritual belief systems. And in fact, really, the idea of the imaginary is also to suggest that there is no one true authentic reality of what this space is. Imagery really says more about the people who make the images rather than the reality of what they represent. Let's go look at some maps, because that might help.
One map on display from the 16th century offers a sharp contrast to some of the works in the exhibit from contemporary indigenous artists based in countries like Brazil, Peru, and Colombia.
We have a replica of this map showing Portuguese ships arriving on the shores of Brazil with indigenous people being depicted.
The art exhibit travels through history. One artist takes on a Hollywood stereotype of his country.
What's that?
This cartoon is from the 1940s. Walt Disney famously traveled to Brazil, where he met an accomplished illustrator named Jota Carlos, who had created a parrot character with human traits. Disney returned to Hollywood and introduced his character, José Carioca, a kind of man-about-town parrot from Brazil.
I will show you the land of the samba.
Samba? What samba?
Ah, the samba.
In his paintings of parrots, Brazilian artist Sergio Alivato deals with Disney's plagiarism.
And also because Joe Carioca was given a very bad personality, let's say. Unfaithful, he never wants to work, you know, and that's supposed to represent us.
Alivato painted his parrots on earthy linen and says he stayed true to the actual fauna of the Brazilian Amazon.
I did a lot of research, and it's only Brazilian psittacídeos, Brazilian parrots.
I mean, your renderings are much more Audubon than they are Disney, aren't they?
Yeah. And also, the parrots, they are intrinsically connected to the Brazilian history. The first name of Brazil, it was Land of the Parrots.
The Portuguese called it Terra Papagali.
And also because they were taken by hundreds and hundreds to Europe. They were exploited.
Artist Sergio Alivato wanted to make clear that the Imaginary Amazon show is not just about how people who live in the Amazon see their world. It's really about the rest of us.
It's about being together, everybody together, fighting for the whole planet. That's it.
Imaginary Amazon will be on display at San Diego State University's Art Gallery until May.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.